Welcome to the Shofar Stellenbosch Sermon Series. We hope that you will be blessed by this message. Our sermons are also available on Shofar TV. Go to www.shofaronline.tv to download and share.
It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Teens Jacobs, a man of God. You'll see his smile, it's infectious. And I really want to, scripture says that if we receive a prophet in the name of a prophet, we receive a prophet's reward. So my prayer for us is that we receive Teens, because he is the blessing. And so, yeah, so I want us just to raise our hands forward and just speak a blessing on him, because he is a blessing to us. And so Teens, we receive you and what you want to share with us. We pray God's blessing on you and this morning and your family.
Thanks a lot. All right. Hello, everyone. This side seems a bit more numerous. I think Stellenbosch is a bit like Cape Town. Everyone comes in last minute. So I guess that's why that side is a bit more numerous. It's a great blessing to be with you this morning. You know, as we were worshiping, I just felt in my spirit. I don't know if you know the legacy of this congregation. Some of you have been here for a long time, since almost the inception of this congregation. Some of you might be new to this congregation, but this congregation has always been an engine room. And I want to tell you, still an engine room. What happens in the heart of this congregation is really important, because that goes out. That bears fruit. The people that you produce, where they go, what they do, it's really important. You are still an engine room. And I was so blessed just listening to worship and just seeing the heart of worship that is here. And I think in that regard, maybe the message for this morning is quite apt, what I'm sort of perceiving in my heart. A while ago, I woke up in the morning, and we've got a little guy ourselves, so usually when I wake up in the morning, I'm not quite with it. It usually takes a couple of cups of coffee to get with it. But I woke up, and it's just a verse in my heart, and the verse was that 1 Timothy 6, 6 that we're going to focus on this morning, and it says, "Godliness with contentment is great gain." And the reason why this verse has been sticking with me for quite a while is because wherever I go, one of the huge challenges that we face in South Africa is that people struggle to have hope. You know, hope is something that you look into the future and you see good things. Doesn't mean that you see easy things. It just means that you look forward and you see that God is going to do good things. And I think we're very short of hope in this nation. And I think on a personal level, many people that I speak to, they struggle with hope. What they see is the battles, the fights. What might go wrong? What is the problems? What is the issues? But hope is one of those things that we really need in this nation. And that we really need in our personal lives. Now, that might seem a bit, you know, incongruent, talking about godliness with contentment is great gain, and then talking about hope, doesn't seem that the two quite fit, but there's something in there, and I hope I make sense this morning, because I really feel this is a word for us, and it's certainly a word for me, and I'm thinking a lot about it. But let me maybe take a step back, and obviously these words were written to Timothy. Timothy was at that stage the lead pastor, I guess you can call him, of the Ephesus church, and the Ephesus church is a very important church. The gospel is growing exponentially in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. And at that stage, it was estimated that for every Jewish Christian believer, there was about 100,000 Greek believers. The gospel is really exploding in that area. That's what I'm trying to tell you. And he was a key figure in this church. But Timothy is an interesting character, and you can certainly go and read a slight bit more about him in Acts 16, and I haven't got it on the PowerPoint, but maybe let me just read one or two verses there, where it talks about Paul, who went to Derbe and Lystra, where there was a disciple named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. He was well spoken of by the believers in Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him, and it took him and had him circumcised, because the Jews who were in those places. All right, now there's a world being set in between the lines here. And the thing about Timothy is that he was a young man with uncertain past. His father was Greek, his mother was Jewish, and he was not circumcised. You know what that means? That means he was never fully accepted into the community because he was never circumcised. He could never go to the synagogue. The synagogue was the place where life happened in the Jewish community. It wasn't just a place where they read the scriptures. It was a place where they did business. It was a place where they had judgments about things that had to be corrected. It was a place where they could have conversations. It was a place where the community got together. And if you're not circumcised, you could not enter as a man. Where is his father? We know something about his mother. We know something about his grandparents. We don't know anything about his father. Where is his father? And we see this special relationship developing between Paul and Timothy, and it seems almost like a father-son type of relationship that developed there. And the question is, where is his father? Was his father dead? Did his father abandon him? What happened there? We don't know. But here's a man with a very uncertain past. And maybe you can relate to that. I'm not saying your story is necessarily the same, but maybe you can relate to that uncertain past where the past tends to define you. Where you look at it and you say, my past is not good, so maybe my future won't be good either. You know, many people that I speak to, when they talk about a lack of hope in their lives, they refer back to the past. Because the assumption is the past tends to repeat itself. So what happens will happen again in my life. I had an uncertain past. Beyond that, I had an uncertain present. And, you know, Paul is doing effort to write to this young guy because he's struggling. He's not writing to him because it's, hey, high five all around, Facebook likes for 1,000, let's go. He was writing to him because he really struggled. He said to him, one of the things that he says to him is, don't let other people look down on you. Why did he say that? Because other people looking down on him. I don't know, maybe he sucked in the pulpit. Maybe he didn't make good choices. Maybe he struggled to be confident. I don't know, we don't know. But he struggled at an uncertain present. And in the midst of this, Paul now is writing to him. Paul has got this special relationship with him. Paul is this go-getter guy. Paul is this guy that never stands back. And he's writing to Timothy, and he's giving him advice, and he's saying, listen, this is what you should do. And there's one word in particular that drops all the time in the letters that Paul writes, the pastoral letters that Paul writes. There's one word that drops all the time, and there's a word that he drops quite often to Timothy, and that word is the word godliness. You see, my main message that I want to give to you this morning is that the way to hope is through godliness. Godliness generates hope. That doesn't seem like a natural fit, though. Let's be honest for a moment. That doesn't seem like a natural fit. But I want to look a slight bit deeper at it. One of the things that we see, for example, 1 Timothy 4, verse 7, it says, where Paul writes to Timothy, he says, I have nothing to do with profane myths and old wives' tale. Train yourself in godliness. And then, of course, we find the verse that I've been quoting, 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. It says, godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, there's three components that we need to talk about this morning. We need to talk about godliness, we need to talk about contentment, and we need to talk about gain. In order to understand this verse, we need to talk about godliness, we need to talk about contentment, we need to talk about gain. I want to pose to you that I think these three things are worthy to ponder and worthy to make part of our lives, to generate hope, to generate a sense of understanding how God is moving in our midst. But these are difficult concepts to talk about. What I am going to do after we looked at these three concepts, I'm going to look at the broader context and just quickly read through the chapter itself and make one or two comments about things that tends to steal godliness. But now let's talk about godliness, and godliness is a tough one. Let's be honest here for a moment. If I can be honest, I know this verse well, and maybe you know this verse, I tend to avoid this verse. Whenever somebody says godliness, contentment is great gain, in my mind I go like, ignore, think about something else. Why? Because godliness is a scary concept to us. I mean, what is godliness? One of the ways, I'm just reading here from a commentary, and it says the following. The Greek word of godliness is variously translated as godliness, religion. Oh, we don't like that word. I don't like that word. religious truth. Oh no, it's getting worse. It's like the Springboks playing. Religious life. Oh no, no, no. Authentic religiosity. No, now we're in the deep end. Devotion, divine blessing, and piety. The Greek root is used to describe human conduct to its someone or something considered to be great or in charge. Thus, the best rendering of a Greek word would be respectful conduct. In its various contexts, it describes respectful conduct to its parents, one's country, the law, the keeping of agreements, trustworthy conduct of a slave to its his or her master. Now, let me stop here for a moment. Let's just say the obvious thing. The problem with godliness is that when I say godliness, what I'm thinking of is moral perfection. And I'm not perfect. So godliness is scary because godliness always reminds us of what we can't do and where we can't go and what we struggle with. I mean, I don't know if anyone looked in the mirror this morning and went like, you godly dude, you, huh? Godliness, I'm your boss. Huh? Anyone said that this morning? No? You know, Eugene Peterson uses a Greek mythic story that I often think about because it's so true. And it's very, very well linked to this concept of godliness and our idea of godliness as moral perfection. Let me, before I get to the story, let me maybe just expand a slight bit further. The issue is the moment we bring in, as we read in that quote, religion, right? The reason why we don't like religion is obviously we think of it as something that is dead, but it's not only that. It's also something that we have to do whether we like to do it or not, something we ought to do. Something that is unattainable. It's somebody standing on a very high stage preaching down at you. Luckily, I'm quite short, so we're still equal. But somebody preaching down at you, telling you how it is, and you're going, I can't carry this burden. I can't carry this weight. The worst thing you can tell somebody that is struggling is to give them something more to do. It's like a comedian, I was laughing, read something a comedian said about children. He said, having a third child, I don't have three children, so I don't know, some of you might know. But he said, having three children is like drowning, and as you're drowning, you stretch out your hands and somebody hands you a baby. Huh? And godliness is almost like that. You're drowning, you're struggling, you don't know what to do, and then somebody tells you, this is what you better do, and you're like, I'm already drowning, how am I supposed to do this? Right? That's a problem of moral perfection. You're struggling in your marriage and somebody tells you, okay, here's the 5 steps that you need to do. And you can all agree with the 5 steps. You all go like, yes, it is moral perfection, but I struggle even to smile. Huh? Now, Eugene Peterson tells a story. It's not his story. It's a Greek mythic tale. And the Greeks, they were a weird bunch. But they had very interesting stories, and often these stories pointed towards the human heart, as mythic stories tend to do. So it's not a true story, but it's a story of a old man called Procrustes, and Procrustes had an inn that was next to the sea, and makes me think of Comiskey. I live quite close to Comiskey. And in those days, what would happen is, obviously, you didn't have an SUV, you didn't have a car, you had to walk wherever you wanted to be. So people would walk from one town to another, and as they walk past his house, and he had this very nice house with this great stoop in the shade, and he's like, please come in, man, come in. And like, oh, shade, that's what I need, Greece. They don't have a lot of trees there, it's you, just you and the sun. So, shade, you sit down, he says, can I give you something to drink? Hemmerbeer. I don't know how he would have it, but, you know, yes, please, give me something to drink. So he brings you something to drink, and it's so nice. And, you know, it's already late in the day, you've been walking all day, you're dirty and dusty and sweaty. And he says, can I give you something to eat? And you're like, yes, please, give me something to eat. And you have something to eat, and it's already a bit dark. And he says, why don't you sleep here tonight? And like, man, that's exactly what I need. I need a mattress. I don't want to sleep on the ground. That's what I need. So then he takes you to a very nice room, and it's nice and cool in the room. And there's a bed in the room, and he says, why don't you lie down? You can sleep here tonight. And tomorrow you're on your way and you say, ah, Procrustes, I love you so much, man. I love you. Look at this nice room. Look at this nice mattress. But there is a but. In the middle of the night, you wake up and Procrustes is standing next to you. And here's the catch. The catch is that the mattress, the bed, is according to the dimensions of the length of a perfect Greek man. And if you're too short, he puts you on the rack and he stretches you out. And if a shoulder pops, so what? If a hip pops, so what? You need to be the perfect length. If you're too tall, let me purvey the brothers here. Maybe yes. If you're too tall, what does he do? He takes a sword and he chops. Bang. Foot off. It hurts, but who cares? Because when morning comes, you have the length, you have the dimensions, the height of a perfect Greek man. Only problem is no one walks out there without a limp. And that's the thing about moral perfection. Moral perfection is good. Moral perfection is ideal. But we're not able to do it. And with moral perfection, because we don't attain it, eventually we walk with a limp. Eventually somebody around you walk with a limp because the expectation just becomes crushing, isn't it? And that's why I tend to stand clear of this word godliness, because I can't attain it. I've tried. And look, I'm like you, I'm pretty stubborn. I've tried. But there's always something. That's a blessed thing about marriage. There's always somebody else to point you out as well. What the things you need to grow in still. Hallelujah. I've tried. Then we go, but godliness, that's not me. That's not for me. I don't know how to do this. But I think we're missing a point here. Perhaps the whole essence of godliness is not so much moral perfection, it's something else. And I think Melina and Pulch is giving a tip here. They're saying that godliness, the essence of godliness, if we look at the Greek word, the essence of godliness is a certain change of behavior because you're in the presence of somebody greater. That when you come into the presence of God, something changes about you. Now the question is, what is that something that changes? I want to take you to Romans 8 verse 29. And it talks about God and it says, for God knew his people in advance and he chose them to become like his son. You see, the essence of godliness is not moral perfection. The essence of godliness is Christ-likeness. The essence of godliness is not to set a standard and to say, I will attain the standard. And please, don't get me wrong. Morality is important. To have high moral standards is important. To grow in morality is really important. I'm not talking about that. Well, I'm talking about the essence, the heart, the engine room of it. The engine room is I change because I come into the presence of God. And because I come into the presence of God, what changes about me? My morality, yes, but that's not the essence of it. The essence of it is God wants me to become like Jesus. God wants me to become Christ-like. And what is Christ-likeness? What is Christ-likeness? And yeah, I think we really get to the deepest part of it. Christ-likeness is to continually be willing to embrace a broken world. Christ-likeness is not to harden your heart. Christ-likeness is not to retreat to safe places and to say, this is just too hard. Other people's problems, it's just too hard. What is happening in South Africa is just too hard. What is happening in my family is just too hard. What is happening in the community, what's happening in Stellenbosch, perhaps in the university, is just too hard. So I retreat. So I harden my heart. See, Christ-likeness is the willingness to engage a broken world. And the moment we're willing to do that, it's not moral perfection, it's a willingness. The moment we're willing to do it, something changes within us. We become more like Jesus. See, this was not an easy thing for Jesus to do, but this is the essence of what Jesus did when he came to us. He engaged our brokenness. See, Jesus didn't walk around all day telling everyone how perfect he is. Other people recognized his perfection. What did he do? He walked all day around and he engaged people that were broken. That is Christ-likeness. You see, we lose our godliness the moment we harden our heart. We grow in godliness the moment we're still willing to drink that cup and to pick up that cross. Now, I tell you, that is a difficult thing, isn't it? Because it involves sacrifice. And there comes a stage where I say, okay, enough is enough. Enough bad news. Enough struggles. See, maybe you sacrificed to somebody in church and you got hurt in the process. Maybe you opened your heart in family, you got hurt in the process. Maybe you open your heart to the community, you get hurt in the process, and you say, I will learn my lesson. I will not do this again. But the moment we do that, we lose the essence of Christ-likeness. The essence of Christ-likeness is not to have a perfect answer, because I certainly don't have a perfect answer. Maybe you do. Please come to the front and take the mic from me then. Okay. But chances are we don't have a perfect answers here among us. I don't have a perfect morality. I can't say to people, hey, don't sweat, I'm here. Maybe you can. Again, please then, Robert, come and take the mic from my hand. But chances are you don't have either. But godliness is the willingness to keep on opening my heart. To keep on saying, I will drink this cup. You see, what we need in this country is more people with a profound sense of a calling for South Africa. You're not accidentally born here. You're not on a train station waiting to go to London, Timbuktu. It's weird. No one ever comes to me and say, I have a calling for Pofadder. Anyone in Pofadder? I have a calling for Timbuktu. I haven't had anyone come to me and say, I have a calling for Syria. We always have a calling for something that we see as a better place than where we are currently, isn't that? But that's not a calling, by the way. Often that's an effort to escape. You know, one of the prophets that often speaks to my heart is a guy called Jonah. Because whenever I feel inadequate as a pastor, I go and read Jonah. I go like, man, my attitude certainly didn't suck as this guy. Huh? God speaks to him clearly. He says, I'm going to Spain. You know, Toshis is Spain. Spain is nice, man. Have you ever been in Barcelona? You can go and watch the soccer giants, you know, have a little do there. You can eat all kinds of little thingies there. It's very nice. Spain is very nice. I've been there. Very nice. I'm going to Spain, baby. And then a fish swallows him. I mean, how do you put that on Facebook? I see these days on Facebook, it's just videos and pictures. I mean, do you take like, you know, today I'm hors d'oeuvre. I don't know. How do you take a picture inside the fish's, I don't know. And then it gets spit out and it gives the worst sermon. The worst sermon ever. I feel so encouraged when I read Jonah. Because no matter how bad I preach, I've never sucked like that. Huh? He walks around to the city and he says, 40 days and you're dead. Imagine that's my message this morning. I pitch up here, I take the mic, thanks for baby dedication, love it, test me, worship was awesome, 40 days, you're dead, bye, walk. Somebody's going to call me tomorrow, say, Tiens, what were you doing? Worst sermon ever, the whole city repents. What? But maybe there's a point there. God doesn't need our perfection. Sometimes God doesn't even need our willingness. But I think it's preferable to have a willingness there. I think that's godliness. think godliness is not the perfection in which we dwell, but just to say, God, I don't have answers. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm here. It's Isaiah standing there, Isaiah 6. His cousin has just died in awful circumstances. His cousin tried to be a God man. That's why he died. He died of leprosy. He couldn't even be buried with his fathers. Had to be buried outside of the city. Isaiah the prophet was his chronicler. It means he was his biographer. It means he spent his life with his cousin trying to chronicle the great works that his cousin did. And then his cousin died a leper outside of the city because he lived in a way that was completely unacceptable to God. And in the midst of this, he sees a vision of God. And what happens? He says, yeah, here am I, send me. It's all God needs. That is godliness. That is Christ-likeness. To keep on living sacrificially. I want to appeal to you this morning, don't harden your heart. Don't harden your heart. Don't harden your heart to this nation. Don't harden your heart to your family. Don't harden your heart to your church. Don't harden your heart to yourself. Christ-likeness is willing to keep on drinking the cup and to pick up the cross, because in the midst of that, God does great miracles. In the midst of that, true change comes. In the midst of that, we engage the God, not just of a cross, but the God of a resurrection. That is what generates true hope. So godliness is Christ-likeness for me. The essence of godliness is Christ-likeness, which is a willingness to keep on living sacrificially. The second concept we have to talk about, what is gain? And the word there, gain, means, more accurately speaking, the means of gain, not gain itself. Gain, in other words, is profit, right? It is what you take home. It's not the profit itself, it's a means to the profit. So maybe you have a career, you get a salary for the career. Your career, in other words, there is the means to the gain. Perhaps you have a business, and through that you generate profit. The business is a means to the gain. Perhaps you have investment, and that investment generates profit. The investment, then, is a means to the gain. What is that saying to us? That is saying to us that godliness generates something. Godliness generates something. Godliness is not a fruit, it's a root. Godliness is not the end result. Godliness does something else in the process. It generates something. It is great gain. The third concept we have to talk about is, what is contentment? Now I'm reading here from the IVP New Testament commentary, and it says the following. Paul tells us that the Christian's goal with respect to material things is godliness with contentment. Godliness in Paul's vocabulary means a genuine Christian life, a faithful relationship with God, and a new way of life. Contentment is a Pauline word in the New Testament. It had a prominent place in Stoic philosophy. Now, we have to stop here a bit as well. We spoke about godliness, we spoke about gain, now we're talking about contentment. It had a prominent place in Stoic philosophy where it defined an attitude of self-sufficiency, meaning detachment or independence from things or possessions. Contentment came from within. Okay, now this is really important, and I really hope I say this clear enough. Contentment is a huge issue to us. Contentment is a huge issue to us. When we talk about contentment, usually what happens is we all try and figure out how much of enough is enough. And the answer is, it's never enough. I've never sat with somebody that says to me, my salary is enough. I've never had somebody say to me, you know, I don't pay too much taxes. Contentment is a very difficult situation for us. Now, we need to stop there for a moment, because in our mind, obviously, when we're talking about contentment, what we're talking about is my circumstances. And whether I look at my circumstances and say, okay, I judge it to a certain standard, and in the standard, it's okay. All right, now, for us, that is a huge issue, right? Because we look at our circumstances and we say, it's not enough. So we speak to somebody that's a student, and that person will say, man, if I can only work, I'm so tired of two middle noodles. If only I can work. Then I speak to somebody that started off with their working life, and I say, man, I'm so tired of being alone. If only I'm married. I need that special one. I tend to minister a lot to this demographic, young working people who are just starting with their careers. So they want to go for a jog, and then we jog, and then I'm talking about deep things, man, deep things. Contentment and the essence of it in the Greek, and how did it work for the philosophers. And the next thing, while we're jogging, the person will go, I actually want to talk about a girl. I saw this girl. All right. Contentment. And then you're married. Woo! I'm married. Okay, no. Kids. But not just any kids. Kids that look like they belong to a magazine article. Yeah. And then it's not just kids, it's a lifestyle. Man, if I'm only retired. 45, retired, baby. I'm going for it. Now, I don't know what comes after retirement. Somebody please help me there. I think then, you know, what comes after that? Help me. But here's the thing. Contentment is hard for us because we always judge whatever's happening in our lives and going, it's maybe not good enough. Maybe there's something else better out there. And I'm not saying you're going to be where you are forever. I'm not saying you're going to be a student forever. Your parents will certainly not like that. I'm not saying you're going to be single forever. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying you're not going to have kids. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that in any way. All that I'm saying is that contentment is really hard for us because instead of understanding what God is doing in our lives right now, we're always looking for something better. And then we're not even talking about our work. Now, it might be that you're working for Donald Trump. Might be the case and you're looking for a new job. But it's so hard for us to have contentment because we're always looking out for something else. Now, that is our context of contentment. Now, the people that Paul were writing to, mostly Greek-speaking people, very steeped in philosophy, and philosophy... maybe, you know, in our terms, it's sort of academic discipline. It's sort of deep thinkers. Maybe it's a bit abstract. What has that got to do anything with life? In those days, philosophy was more like a street-level conversation. Obviously, they had the deep guys as well, and they had schools of philosophy. But the main question about philosophy is, how can I have a good life? It wasn't the only question. There's lots of other questions. But it was something that was very much discussed all around. And the Stoics were a particularly prominent school of philosophy at the time. And what they said is the word contentment for them was actually self-sufficiency. I need to be independent. I need to be self-sufficient. I need to be detached. Now, this is very important. So we're talking about two concepts of contentment. For our concept of contentment is how much of enough is enough. For them, contentment was, how can I be self-sufficient so that nothing can take me out? So whatever happens around me, I'm safe. Now we do have a connection of that sort of concept as well, and we'll get to that a slight bit later. So when Paul is talking about contentment, what contentment is he talking about? What is contentment? What is true contentment? I want to pose to you, I'm going to show to you here, Philippians 4, verse 11 to 13, says the following. Not that I'm referring to being in need, for I've learned to be content. That's that word again. So it's Paul writing to Timothy, Paul now writing to the church in Philippi, and it says the following. Not that I'm referring to being in need, for I've learned to be content with whatever I have. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. Now he's giving us a tip here for Paul, contentment. Is not in how much I have. I can have little, I can have much, but none of that determines contentment. In any and all circumstances, I've learned the secret of being well fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and being in need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. For Paul, contentment is to be dependent on Jesus no matter your life circumstances. Whether you're student, whether you're single, whether you're married, whether you're drowning with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 kids, whether you're struggling to go to a point of retirement, whether you are retired, whether you are healthy, whether you're not healthy, whether you're financially strong, whether you're financially struggling, the key issue is not to figure out how much of enough is enough. The key issue is not to figure out how can I get to the place where I'm completely self-sufficient. The key issue is to be dependent on Jesus wherever you are. That is true contentment. Now remember, we're talking about godliness with contentment being a generator of something good. And I want to pose to you, this morning, that when we have true godliness, which is Christ-likeness, and when we have true contentment, which is dependency on Jesus, we will have in any and every circumstances of life, true hope. True hope. Because I engage the brokenness of this world with the heart of Christ. And in the midst of this brokenness of the world, I'm truly dependent on Jesus, which means that I allow God to come and be God. You see, for me, hope comes. For me, in my natural state, the tense bit in me, hope comes when I figured out a plan. Hope comes when I've got all the answers. Hopes come when I can see it. But that is a thin sort of hope. That is a very weak, puny, small hope. A godly hope is when I become Christ-like and dependent on Jesus. Now, Paul is writing here to Greek believers. And I think our conclusion can be of this verse. Our conclusion can be real riches, a good life, a real life, a meaningful life, a life that we can look forward to, a life that generates good things is to be Christ-like and to have sufficiency in Christ. And you know what? That is attainable. It's not moral perfection. Moral perfection, I can't attain it. This one day we will be morally perfect when we're in heaven, but now we're not. But I can be Christ-like now. I can be willing to live sacrificially. It's still a tough decision, but it's in my grasp. Contentment. I can choose to be dependent on Jesus to say, hey, now I've got a good salary, but it's not going to change how dependent I am on Jesus. Yes, now I have no salary, but it will not change how dependent I am on Jesus. Godliness or contentment is great gain. I want to zoom out and I'm going to finish this morning. I want to zoom out a bit because the challenge is not done for us yet. So we started off, we said, how can we generate hope? Hope is really important to this nation. And hope is something that lives within us. Christ in us for hope of glory. In us. But in order to have hope, I have to connect with Christ. How do I connect with Christ? Not through moral perfection, because you're going to wait quite a while before you connect with Christ. If moral perfection is a criteria. But Christ-likeness. In the moment of sacrifice, in the moment of willingness to drink the cup and to bear the cross, there I engage Christ. In the moment of dependency on Jesus, there I engage Christ. And Christ in me is a hope of glory. But we haven't finished with the challenges. So with that, I'm zooming out a bit and I'm going to read the verses, just make one or two comments and then get done with it. If anyone teaches other doctrine and does not agree with the sound teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ and with a teaching that promotes godliness, he is conceited, understanding nothing, but has a sick interest in disputes and arguments over words. From these come envy, quarreling, slandering, evil suspicions, and constant disagreement among people whose minds are depraved and deprived of truth, who imagine that godliness is a way to material gain. Very challenging verses. It means that somebody like me from a pulpit can promote something opposite than godliness. Also means that godliness is not there to have gain in a material sense. It's something deeper, more powerful. But that's not really what I want to get to. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world and we can take nothing out. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. Tough words, right? Food and clothing, it's enough. Tough words. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation, a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love, not money itself, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and by craving it, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. Now, of course, these are well-known verses, especially the last couple of ones, and usually how it's misinterpreted is to say that money is the root of all evil. That's not what it says. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. But still, this is an awkward conversation, right? Because money is important. I forgot my wallet at home this morning, and I just have enough petrol to get back home. So you realize again, money is important. I don't want to push a 1,000-kilogram car all the way to Comiket. Trust me, money is important. It's an awkward conversation, right? Money. How much is enough? How much is not enough? Am I godly so that I can get more? Okay, this is opening a broader conversation. I finished with what I see in this verse of godliness, contentment is great gain. What I said there is that godliness, true contentment generates hope. But there's a wider context that we need to talk about here, and that is now the context of how do we deal with material possessions around us. And why is Paul connecting these two? Because he could have said godliness, contentment is great gain, and that's it. Why is he putting it in the context of talking about material possessions? And I think there's two things here that we need to notice here. The first thing, I don't want to comment too much about that. The second one I want to comment a slight bit more on. The first thing that we might need to notice here is, number one, the danger is that Christ becomes a means to us for a more comfortable way of living. Now, I want to say this from the bottom of my heart. I want to tell you, that's not a good foundation to build your faith upon. That's not a good foundation to build your faith upon. I've noticed through years, people walk away from Jesus because they did not get what they always wanted. And maybe you've noticed that as well. I want to tell you, if that is the case, now this is a hard truth, and that I need to examine my own heart with that, and I ask you that you examine your own heart with that. But the reality is, if what you wanted was a certain lifestyle or a certain career or a certain thing in your life, I'm not denouncing it as bad. I'm not saying what you wanted was bad. Maybe what you want is really good. Maybe what that person wanted is really good. All I'm saying is that if that was the ultimate thing, then that thing is God. And Christ is not. See, Christ is not the way to material gain. Christ is the way to God. There's a difference between the two. And you can have much in life and never have God. And you can have little in life and have all the riches of God. By the way, the reverse is also true. You can have little in life and nothing of God. And you can have much material things and have much of the riches of God. It's nothing got to do with nothing in a certain sense. But it's understanding that Christ is the way to God. Christ is not the way to a better life per se. I need to be careful with what I'm saying here. But the question is, what are we aiming at? Am I here today because I want to solve the problem, or am I here because I want Jesus? Huge difference between the two. I need to examine my own heart. I'm not better than this. I'm not better than this. I need to examine my heart. I also do examine your heart. But there's a second point. That's actually what I want to comment on. Here's the problem with material things. There's nothing wrong with material things. If you've got a huge SUV, God bless you. That's awesome. If you have a fork seat, God bless you. It's awesome. If you only have your feet walking, God bless you. That's awesome. All right? It's got nothing to do with nothing. You're not better. You're not worse. It's got nothing to do with nothing. But here's the problem with material things. Material things tend to steal our dependency on Jesus. That's why the love of money is such a danger, because remember what we said is godliness, contentment is great gain. The problem is that the love of money robs us. It steals. It usurps our dependency on Jesus. Remember what I said, that for the Greeks, contentment was self-sufficiency. Often we aim at money for self-sufficiency. If I have enough money, I can build walls that is high enough. I can have a car that's big enough. I can never be under threat. And the understanding of that, the reason for that might not be a bad reason, but the problem is it may steal your faith. I'm not saying it is. You find people that are wealthy that has got faith more than me. That's not the point. I'm not saying the one correlates to the other one automatically. I'm saying that's a danger that's involved with it. And we need to understand the danger. The danger is that the love of money, material things, material gain, can rob me of my dependency on Jesus. It can rob me of a Christ-likeness, of being willing to sacrifice. And if I'm forewarned, I'm forearmed. I can do something about it. Can I leave two practical suggestions with you? This is practical suggestions. I'm not going to say Noah 1 verse 1 says, thou shalt. I don't know. Something like that. I'm not making a legalistic thing here. I'm not saying this is what you will do, this is what you must do. But I'm giving you two suggestions in terms of how to safely deal with material things so we can grow in godliness and contentment. Everyone with me? Can I quickly give those two suggestions, two practical suggestions? Number one, curb or cap your lifestyle. Curb or cap your lifestyle. Godliness or contentment is great gain. What's the problem with as we grow in our financial income? What's the problem? We adjust our lifestyle. So then you have a Foxy, then you have a Golf, then you have, boom, something amazing. But imagine you cap your lifestyle and you say, this is enough. I will live modestly. This is what I'll live for. And whatever else I get, whatever else God blesses me with, because material gain is a blessing from God. I'm not saying material gain is an evil thing. I'm saying how we handle it is important. That's what I'm saying. Everyone's still with me. Hugely important. So the material gain, whatever God gives me, I want to use accurately. So if I cap my lifestyle and say, I will live modestly, whatever else God gives me, I will plow that into good causes for the growth of a community. Now, somebody that inspires me a lot is a guy called Rick Warren. For years, he was a pastor, and then he wrote a little book called The Purpose-Driven Life. And that thing is a money spinner, baby. You know what he did? He paid back 20 years of salary to the church. He lives off 10% of income. And it's not like his children doesn't have braces or anything like that. I'm not talking about choosing a type of lifestyle where you only will eat Provitas. And if you're lucky, maybe a Sardine on top of it. I'm not talking about that. Please don't hear me wrong. I'm just saying, if you cap your lifestyle, you will never live to fulfill a lifestyle. Your lifestyle will never become your God. But instead, you will use whatever else you get for good things. That is a very good practical suggestion. I don't know. But chances are you're going to grow in your career. You're going to go forward. What will happen when you reach the pinnacle of what you have? How will you use your resources? Will that become your source of dependency or independence? Your source of sufficiency or self-sufficiency? It's the second suggestion I want to give. And that is to build a career that serves a community. You know, I don't know what qualifications you have. I don't know what sort of field you are in terms of your career. But you know what? The community needs you. So this is the second suggestion. I'm not saying you should do both. I'm saying perhaps you should consider either or. Maybe choose a career that will serve a community. You know, my wife is a medical specialist. We counted the other day, between the two of us, we've got 22 years of tertiary education. Yes, we like that studying thing, hey? We love it. She's a medical specialist. She doesn't work in private care. There's nothing wrong with working in private care. But the point is, she chose to serve a community. She works in a state hospital system. And I tell you what, it is tough in the state hospital. Some of her colleagues has been abducted, killed. She's worked for a long time in Khayelitsha. Every day we're sitting, we're talking about the issues that she faces every day. I mean, this is our typical conversation. I go home, she says, how was your day? I say, man, I saw this person was really struggling with this. Well, not details, but you know what I mean. And this was, oh, and this was emotionally a bit tough, and this, and then, how was your day? Now, this one is dead, that one is dead, that one is done. And you're, okay, that's a different world. But you know something that I noticed when she was working at Khayelitsha Hospital? I walked around there and I looked at who was the doctors and I noticed there's very few, if any, Christians there. Because it's uncomfortable. I want to pose to you, build a solid career, but maybe one of the options that you can take is to build your career in serving the community. To take the gifts that you have, a skill that you have, the abilities that you have, and serve a community through that. These are two options by which we refuse to be dictated by the love of money. So those are suggestions from my side. Now what we're going to do, if the band can come to the front again, we're going to have communion together. And I want to also ask us to bring the elements of a communion. And let's just have an attitude of worship. We're going to pray together and just remind ourselves of what Christ has done for us. So let's just give everyone opportunity to get in their places and for the ushers to bring the elements.
Remember that our sermons are also available on Shofar TV. Go to www.shofaronline.tv to download and share.